Support for KNKX comes from WSECU, now offering 3 new Visa credit cards and 3 new checking accounts, with benefits that fit a variety of lifestyles and financial needs. More information is available at WSECU.org. WSECU, serving Washington since 1957.
Hi, Natalie, how are you feeling?
Okay.
Feeling a lot of pressure.
Yeah.
Here's the scene. A nurse and a nurse midwife in scrubs are huddled over the woman in the hospital bed.
Yeah, great job. Breathe for me, Natalie. Breathe. Hi, Natalie.
I'm Gabriel Spitzer. This is Sound Effect. And Natalie here is pretty far along in her labor.
Here we go. Okay, looks like the baby's coming. We're crowding now.
Before long, the baby's head comes into view. Then the shoulders clear the birth canal. And finally, tiny Sophie is in the world. But then, a snag. Blood begins to trickle out of the mother's body.
Okay,
then
good.
It comes in a gush.
All right, we're getting a little more blood than I think we'd like to see, so why don't we go ahead and give the 0.2 milligrams of methogen?
The nurse and midwife are undaunted by the sight of the hemorrhage, and they reassure the mother.
Is everything okay?
You're doing just fine. Yep, we're going to give you a little bit of extra medicine to help stop that bleeding, okay?
The blood flow slows, the tension eases. And then the mood really lightens up as all the players break character. You see, this is not a real birth. It's kind of a dress rehearsal, part of the training that nurse midwives get at the University of Washington's School of Nursing. The baby is made of plastic, filled with water. The placenta looks like somebody crafted it out of felt. And the fake blood comes from a tube attached to a bag. The mother is really nurse educator Jillian Aker, giving a freaking Oscar-worthy performance.
It's a really great experience. I used to be a labor and delivery nurse myself, so I've been with women who've had babies.
Do you ever find you're getting kind of emotionally wrapped up in it?
Sure. I mean, I'm having a baby. It's a very emotional experience.
Are you hot?
I am hot.
Trainer Judy Lazarus says the point of this exercise is to make sure these midwives are ready for anything.
So the point of doing it in the Sim Center is to begin to sort of build the muscle memory and the brain memory so that when it happens the first time in clinical, you have that, oh, I did that. I remember. We did this, and then we did this, and then we did this. And just doing it that one time or two times makes a really big difference for people when they're then in the real-life situation.
Worldwide, about 140,000 women die each year because of hemorrhage, according to the American College of Obstetrics and Gynecology. Jillian Aker has attended plenty of births herself, and she's seen how quickly a bleed can turn serious.
What does a real hemorrhage look like?
It's scary. One of the worst sounds in the world is hearing a waterfall of blood coming out of somebody. And there's a lot that happens. So it's one of the most common obstetric emergencies that we have. And it's also the one that is most deadly to women. And so, you know, we really need to make sure that nurses and midwives are adequately prepared for it. And so it's part of the reason that we do it in this setting is so that, you know, once we have that experience in the real world, it's less scary.
You would not want your midwife to be fainting at the sight of blood, after all. There's just something powerful about blood. The life force, the kinship of family, the reminder of mortality. So our theme today is blood ties, the ways that blood connects us. It's all ahead on Sound Effect from 88.5. When you do lose blood in a medical setting, and it's not a pretend childbirth, you may be comforted to know that there are gallons of the stuff on ice waiting to replenish your body's supply. Every year, more than 14 million blood transfusions take place in the United States. But there's a good-sized group that's not part of that number. Jehovah's Witnesses do not accept transfusions under any circumstances. The belief comes from lines in the Bible admonishing people to, quote, abstain from blood. So you have this group of people committed to avoiding other people's blood, and you have a medical establishment that considers transfusions low risk, routine, and life-saving. So that may seem like an unbridgeable gap. But as Sound Effect contributor Alex Ashley reports, witness communities and doctors are working together to find solutions.
Jeffrey Heckman is in his 60s with salt and pepper hair. He isn't much for small talk. He has sort of a Joe Friday, just the facts, ma'am approach. But as we sit at his dining room table in Snohomish, he agrees to tell me about what happened to him a few years ago, a time when he almost died.
Things were accelerating. You couldn't move. You couldn't do anything to alleviate the pain.
It was August 2014. Jeff was in the San Juan Islands with some friends and family at a vacation home in Friday Harbor.
And I was doing a little bit of Bible study while the girls were preparing breakfast.
And then, out of nowhere.
It's like, uh-oh, what's this? This is not a normal feeling. And it's like these hot vice grips are collapsing your chest.
Jeff was rushed to the hospital on San Juan Island. By the time he got there, both of his arms were numb. He couldn't walk. The doctor did an electrocardiogram, an EKG, which records electrical activity in the heart. Something was very wrong.
In about 5 minutes, the doctor came out and said, hey, we've ordered a chopper for you. Where do you want to go?
Later, when we were at the hospital, and he's going to be put on the helicopter, and I'm just busy filling in all this paperwork.
That's Jeff's wife, Lorraine.
They came over and asked me what I weighed. And I weighed too much to be added to the chopper, so I had to come down on the ferry on my own.
With Jeff on the helicopter, along with the flight crew and all their equipment, there wasn't room for Lorraine. So while Jeff was in the air, she drove to Everett, about a three-hour journey from Friday Harbor.
I remember the police escorting me from the hospital to the front of the ferry line.
And they kept saying, do you have more pain? And I said, I did. Somewhere in all of that, I passed out. We landed on top of Providence. I have no recollection.
By the time they got Jeff ready for surgery, Lorraine had just gotten off the ferry. She was still over an hour away.
My brother-in-law, Kevin, called and said, they can't wait any longer for you to get here. They're going to take him into surgery. And I think you need to... you might need to say goodbye. So that was a crazy conversation because, of course, he was full of drugs and there were cars whizzing by. And
so it was explained to me later that I had an aortic dissection and I'd never heard of that before.
What happened to Jeff is rare. Basically, it's when the large blood vessel branching off from the heart tears open. 80% of patients die before they ever get to the hospital. And if you are among that surviving 20%, then you have to survive open heart surgery. So when Jeff landed at Providence Medical Center in Everett, the stakes were high.
And the doctor came out and said, I want this man into the surgery now. Whatever you're doing, get him in there. I'm ready.
But there was a catch.
I remember someone saying to me, are you one of Jehovah's Witnesses? And I said, yeah, I'm one of Jehovah's Witnesses. And they said, do you take blood? And I said, no, I don't.
Jeff was about to go into open heart surgery, and having a blood transfusion was off the table. As one of Jehovah's Witnesses, he believed a blood transfusion violated specific laws in the Bible about abstaining from blood. I know this because I'm a witness too.
So Jehovah's Witnesses believe that blood transfusion is prohibited by such Bible passages as Genesis 9, 3 and 4, and Leviticus 17, 13 and 14, and Acts 15, 19 and 20, which simply say to abstain from blood.
This is Jim Higgins. He's one of Jeff's friends, a fellow elder.
And although those verses are not stated in medical terms, we view them as in religious terms, that we rule out transfusion of whole blood, red blood cells, white blood cells, platelets, and plasma.
Jim is also a member of the Seattle Hospital Liaison Committee. The HLC is a committee of specially trained elders among Jehovah's Witnesses who are taught how to work with the medical community, how to help members of their congregations get the best treatment possible without violating their beliefs. There's about 1,700 of these committees around the world. Three of them are in Washington State.
So as a liaison, we're working with the community, the Jehovah's Witness community, and the hospital. And our role is always defined by the fact that we're not clinicians. We are ministers. So we're not there to tell the doctors how to do their job. But what we are there for is to help our members find doctors that will work with our members, that will honor our stand on non-blood management for a case or for surgery.
EUA, EMERGENCY DEPARTMENT, ROOM 5081.
The doctor Jim found to help Jeffrey was James Brevig. Dr. Brevig has performed dozens of bloodless surgeries at Providence Medical Center in Everett and was open to taking Jim's case. When I met Dr. Brevig, he was still in his scrubs. He had already had a full day of surgery, procedures that last hours at a time. This maybe was the first time he'd sat down all day. Brevig is the first to admit that blood transfusions do, in fact, save lives. There's no argument there. But he also says the use of blood is not in step with Western medicine.
We dose medications in milligrams or micrograms or milligrams per kilogram or micrograms per kilogram per minute. We do trials of drugs based on body weight, and we're very careful with dosing. But that doesn't really exist for blood. Blood is a vital, irreplaceable bodily fluid, and we as surgeons and healthcare professionals ought to treat it that way, rather than treating it like motor oil or brake fluid, and if you lose some, you pour some more in.
Brevig says blood transfusion was rushed into practice during World War II because of the severe loss of blood on the battlefield. By the time the war ended in 1945, the American Red Cross had collected 13 million pints.
So the dose of blood is a unit of blood, which is a pint. What, we dose nothing else in pints. What kind of dose is that? I mean, it's crazy. I can't give them a half a unit of blood, by the way. I have to give them a whole unit. They only come in units. So that's, if I want to dose an antibiotic, I can tell the pharmacy how many milligrams I'd like to give, and I'll get it. But I can't tell them how many milliliters of blood I want. I either get 1 pint or I get 2 pints. So it's really, it's sort of a backwards, grandfathered in anachronism.
As he treated patients like Jehovah's Witnesses who refused blood products altogether, Brevig says his views about blood transfusions began to shift.
The vast majority of those patients did not suffer any adverse consequence from their decision not to accept blood products.
When Dr. Brevig operated on Jeffrey, he was in surgery for a full 10 hours.
Those cases are typically treated with lots of blood products because they tend to have a lot more bleeding. And so it means that I have to be very meticulous with my surgical technique.
And I've thanked Dr. Brevig for his clever hands and his team in saving my life. And then he's monitored me for the last 3 years to make sure that everything's going just fine. And the fact that I'm here.
Hearing Jeffrey's story reminds me that I may be in his position someday. Medical emergencies are more complicated for Jehovah's Witnesses. But that doesn't mean we're not prepared. In fact, we sort of train for moments like this. Most of us keep what we casually call a no-blood card in our wallet. Luckily, more doctors are open to trying different approaches, from slow and careful surgical procedures to blood-saving techniques including a device known as a cell salvage machine. I like to think that these medical advances are helping more people than just those who share my beliefs. Maybe the doctors who do these procedures find a kind of grace in reaching beyond what some would say is an overused therapy. I think Dr. Brevig put it best when I asked his opinion about blood.
I'm not really a religious person, but the closest thing to me that is sacred is a patient's bodily integrity and their organs, and their blood is part of that.
That story from sound effect contributor Alex Ashley. To see what a cell salvage machine looks like and to hear more about how bloodless techniques work, you can go to our website at knkxsoundeffect.org. This is Sound Effect from 88.5. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and our theme today is Blood Ties. We're going to hear two stories now of people wrestling with what blood ties really are and who are the people we consider family. We start at the Hebald Cultural Center near Marysville.
Yalyashta is my Indian name. Lois Landgreeb is my English name.
Lois is a Tulalip tribal member who, for 23 years, has taught a language called Lashutseed.
One of my favorite is the word for frog, and that is wuk wuk. The word for bird is ch'ch'alkub. And another one is eagle. It sounds like wings on air. Yahwala.
Lachute seed is endangered. Lois says maybe 55 people speak her dialect fluently. And as you can probably guess, it's not an easy language to just pick up. Especially when, like Lois, you were 25 years old and starting from scratch. That's because Lois did not start out on a path toward becoming a tribal culture bearer. Instead, her life has taken a series of unexpected turns, starting with when she was just minutes old.
I was relinquished at birth. My birth mother held me for 5 minutes, and she gave me up. I was in foster care for almost a year, and I was adopted by a white family, and they adopted both me and my brother. So we're not blood siblings, but we look at each other as we're practically like blood. My adopted mother, she had had miscarriages and stillborn, so that's why they adopted. She had a miracle baby, and it was my sister. So just before she was born, the neighborhood kids informed us that they're going to give us back, that they're going to give us up because they now have their own child. And we didn't know that we were adopted. We did not figure anything out any differently. It's really funny because my dad and mom would get pink and sunburned in the summer. And my brother and I would get dark brown. It never occurred to us. We just figured that's the way it was. So,
how old were you when those neighborhood kids were telling you that you were going to be given back?
6 years old, 6 and 7. So my brother and I decided we're going to be the best children ever. They can't give us back. So we devised a plan to just behave ourselves. And we messed up like children do. And we broke down and started crying. We sobbed uncontrollably for like 5 minutes. Don't give us away. We want to stay. They really had to sit with us and explain that, yes, we're sorry you found out this way. And that we went out and seeked you out. We picked, you know, we could have picked any children, any babies, any, but we saw you two, and that's who we wanted, and we're not giving you back.
So you learned at that time, though, that you were Native. You didn't know any more than that. What was your relationship like to your nativeness?
There was basically just the romance stereotype attachment. Basically, I loved getting my hair braided. And, of course, I had my dad make a strap deal where I could put a doll on my back. So I was really excited about that. And when we had Native Month, we made drums out of oatmeal containers, like Quaker oatmeal. When I was 11, my adopted mother passed away of stomach cancer. So that was just a trauma that we couldn't quite get over. My dad remarried 8 months later to my stepmother, and she was totally different. She didn't like us, which really traumatized my brother and I more. I ended up being a runaway, 13 to 16 years old, and my brother left after I turned 13. I ended up graduating high school, and my brother had found this organization called WARM, Washington Adoptees Right Movement Organization. And he got a case opened, and he wanted to seek out his birth mother. And he got the information, you know, they found her, and you know, we were all excited for him, a little nervous too. And she turned him down. So, and she didn't want to meet him. So he kind of sat me down and said, look for your mom. And I was like just devastated for him. It just broke me a little, and I said, I don't think I could handle being rejected. And so I decided not to. About that time, my boyfriend and I, we got married, and I had my first child. I was devastated a little bit because losing my mom came back when I became a mom. So I went through a little bit of depression. And after the birth of my son, a minister of the Lutheran Church I went to a few times came knocking at my door. And he said, Lois, you know, your family's looking for you. I said, what? I'm like sitting there going, they know where I'm at. And the minister, the pastor said, we got a call from your aunt and uncle. Were you adopted? And I literally had to grab a counter and sit down. And I said, yes, I am. So that's when I spoke to my mom on the phone for the first time. We were both just so excited to hear each other. But when it came to the actual physical meeting, it was just before Thanksgiving. She got there an evening early, and it was snowing. I mean, it was like there's already been about almost a foot of snow in Wenatchee. And I had to push our son's stroller through the snow to get to the motel because we didn't have a car. And got there to the door, and I absolutely could not knock. It was like almost like 10 degrees out. And my husband's looking at me, Jeff, and he goes, you know, are you going to knock? And I said, no, I can't. I'm about to meet her. And then he just, oh, for goodness, and he knocks. We're going to freeze. And she's inside with her husband, Arnie. And they heard the knock. And Arnie looks over at her and says, well, you going to get it? She froze and she goes, no, what if it's her? And Arnie goes, oh my goodness, we got to let him in. Went over and opened the door. I saw a short lady with dark hair and a face just like mine. And I stepped in and she saw me for a few seconds and she stepped back and lowered her head because she didn't know what I was going to do. I saw that gesture and I thought, oh, she's had it hard just like me. You know, and I just stepped forward and put my arms around her and she just melted into my shoulders and we both just cried. It was a void that I think I say that God or the Great Spirit had made just for, you know, our relationship to become what it became. I think I had to have that loss of one mom just to make room for Carol McKay Henry to step into my life and make it easier.
You've had so many different experiences with family, with adopted family, with a stepmother, with an adopted brother, with half-brothers and blood mothers and everything. What has this taught you about the nature of family and the nature of blood relations?
I think that it's taught me to forgive. It's taught me to accept. What's that famous serenity prayer? The knowledge to change what I can and accept what I can't. I first heard about that when I became a mother, so that's all 30 years of learning of what that really means.
Lois Landgrebe is a teacher and storyteller. She currently works for the Sauk Suattle tribe. Now we're going to hear the story of someone who made a similar journey, but in reverse. Our theme is Blood Ties here on Sound Effect. I'm Gabriel Spitzer. Darren Maypower has blood relatives, but he spent almost his entire childhood searching for another kind of family, a family that he would choose and who would choose him. Sound Effects' Jennifer Wing has the story.
One of the first things you notice when you meet Darren Maypower is his enormous smile. He's 21 years old, he's African American, he's got a healthy dose of confidence, and he is just on the cusp of launching into the world.
I attend Central Washington University as a junior, studying communications and minoring in Russian. It's going good. I would say it's going good.
Darren is in a very different emotional space from when he was a young child. When he was 5 years old, the person he was closest to, his mother, made the incredibly difficult choice of putting him into foster care.
She took me to an office, we signed the papers, and then I remember getting a social worker assigned, like immediately. His name was Jeremy. I remember Jeremy. He put me in a car seat, took me to my first foster home.
Do you remember the reason why she said that this had to happen?
Every night we were in and out of shelters on the street. We really didn't have any place to go. And my mom told me she wanted a better life for me. It was the right thing. I can't be mad. I can't hate her. I can't dislike her.
Over the years, Darren has lived in 4 different foster homes. In one house, the parents divorced. In another, the mom wouldn't let him watch TV or play sports. By the time he was 16 years old, he ended up in a house in Kent with a single mother and 2 other kids, and it still wasn't the right fit. He was struggling.
I started to see my grades really slipping, and like I got my first D, and I was just like, whoa, this is like not reflecting on who I want to be or who I am.
At this point, even though Darren was less than 2 years away from being an adult, he was still hoping to find a family to call his own.
I was honestly ready for stability. I was ready for something solid where I didn't have to worry about, like, if I get in trouble, will I have to move, or will the parents hate me and like neglect me? I just wanted the title of like parents.
Okay, so we're going to put Darren's story on pause for a little bit and meet 2 new people, Carrie Power and Christine Colling. They live on Vashon Island. They're white, middle-aged women with graying hair. They met 15 years ago through mutual friends, and it was at a party at a lake when something deeper was at play, something more than just good conversation.
Oh, life has its funny twists and turns. I had no idea I was gay until I fell in love with Carrie.
I was very honest and told Christine how I felt.
She said, I like you, and I was about to say thank you so much, but not for me, when she said, I know you like me too. And I went, oh, and had to admit she was right.
Carrie teaches middle school. Christine is an elementary school counselor. And they know they want to start a family. And at first they think, baby.
And we're looking at each other going, man, we're kind of old.
Carrie and Christine become licensed to be foster parents. Instead of an infant, they decide to look for an older child in elementary school. And the goal is adoption. They start getting referrals, and these are documents that describe a particular child, but these papers, they don't hold a lot of information.
You know, there might be a sentence or two, and the kid likes Legos and pizza and hates spaghetti or something like that. It doesn't tell you much about that child's personality. Plus, you're managing some guilt and not wanting just to adopt every kid that comes your way.
Mm-hmm. And it's heart-wrenching, yeah.
I'm not truly rejecting this child, but boy, it sure feels like it when you're saying no thank you.
Then Christine has an idea.
Carrie, we've been so focused on looking for elementary age kids. Why don't we look at teenagers?
I was thinking you were crazy.
You were definitely thinking I was crazy. I got the you're crazy look. Mm-hmm.
And then out of the blue, a social worker approaches Carrie and Christine and asks them,
would you be interested in adopting a teenager? We said, well, maybe. And she said, well, I know this young man, and I think you'd be a really great fit for him. And that young man was Darren.
A few weeks later, Darren, Christine, and Carrie meet for the first time in person in the natural habitat for a 16-year-old, South Center Mall in Tukwila.
When I first laid eyes on Carrie and Christine, I thought, they look sweet.
Whoa, he's tall. And he had really big hair at the time, and he had that smile.
I didn't know what else to think. I didn't want to have any bias. I didn't want to have any preconceived notions. I just wanted to learn them as it went.
He approached people with kindness.
He was polite, and he still, to this day, holds the door open for us.
Everyone feels in their gut that they have finally found what they have been looking for. At age 17, Darren becomes Carrie and Christine's son. The papers get signed. A new family is born. Darren moves to Vashon Island. He enrolls in high school. It's his third one at this point, and settles into his new life. Then, in his last year of high school, Darren makes a really bad decision.
My senior year, I thought I really, really loved this girl. And it was just a really, really unhealthy relationship. And that led me to say some really nasty things to her over text, which in turn got me arrested for DV harassment.
DV meaning domestic violence harassment. That's a thing with text.
Yep, gross misdemeanor. DV harassment, ended up doing about 26 hours in jail, you know, missed school prom, and I was able to graduate, couldn't walk in graduation, and I had to be on probation just recently. That was dropped.
What were your worries when you were going through this with your parents?
What really, really led to this is the fact that I didn't tell them anything at first. I didn't know what to tell them or what to say. I didn't know what they were comfortable with. This is just all new. It's all new. Everything. The school, the girl, the parents, the house, everything was new. And so I just was choosing to handle it myself because that's how I always handle things, myself.
It was such a hard time. But I think it was the beginning of Darren realizing that we weren't gonna throw him out, that this is what family is. That we make mistakes and we figure it out together.
After everything happened, we were able to talk about it. I was able to tell them because, you know, the cat was out of the bag type deal.
You had to tell them.
Yeah, but pretty much. And so I let it out. Then they were able to see that I can be honest with them.
There was a huge shift after that.
This family of three is growing. When Carrie and Christine adopted Darren, they came home with hundreds of pages of paperwork from the state detailing the events of his life. Buried in these documents is the fact that Darren has seven brothers and sisters. Darren didn't know this. Last year, one of Darren's sisters started looking for him. Now, this would be big news for anyone, but for Darren, who has gone through most of his life alone, to know that there are people he's related to who have a shared history, this is huge.
I know that there's someone blood out there that came from the same mom I did, that's close to me, that honestly would probably better understand my personality better than my friend of 5 years. Like, that's how it feels. It's like there's those people now that I can just reach out to.
A few of his siblings live in California, and recently, Darren, Christine, and Carrie took a trip there to meet them.
What we're learning is that we didn't just adopt Darren. We, in a lot of ways, have adopted that family as he discovers them. We are enjoying discovering this new expanded family we never knew we'd have.
I asked Darren, as Christine and Carrie's son, if he's prepared to someday take care of them as they get older, the way that they're caring for him today.
Oh, I am very much so prepared. I have a vision of Darren, me, and my family, my future wife, my future children, and Carrie and Christine all together. We're visiting And, you know, I'm just being my normal self, making everyone happy and laughing. I just have that little blimp in my head because I know it's going to happen one day.
That story from Sound Effects, Jennifer Wing. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, this is Sound Effect, and for our final story of Blood Ties, we have a mother and a daughter working through how blood and language have shaped their relationship. Simone Alicea is a reporter and editor here at KNKX. Her mom, Veronica Alicea Galvan, is a King County Superior Court judge. They came together in a StoryCorps booth to talk about something specific, the bilingual court that Judge Alicea Galvan used to run in Des Moines, Washington. But the conversation strayed pretty quickly into this intimate space where both women learned things about the other that they hadn't known before.
My name is Simone Alicea, and I am Veronica's daughter.
My name is Veronica Alicea Galvan, and I am Simone's mother.
To start, let's talk about why we're here today and what you were approached for.
Well, I was approached because of the Spanish language court that I started when I was a municipal court judge in the city of Des Moines, Washington. We were there for a traffic court, and if you're familiar with municipal courts at all, traffic days are pretty busy. You have 60 to 80 people, and we had about 15 to 20 individuals there who were waiting for the interpreter. Well, the interpreter didn't show up. So I just said to myself, I speak Spanish, they speak Spanish, it's all recorded. So I just started doing them in Spanish.
Did you learn Spanish concurrently with English?
So my great-grandmother spoke only Spanish, and she took care of me a lot as a child. But obviously my dad is from Mexico, and he was monolingual, so he would speak Spanish. My mom is bilingual. She knows Spanish and English. But in terms of my childhood, we would live here one year and we would live in Mexico another year. And you obviously learned both languages simultaneously. And at some point, they just kind of stick together. My father picked fruit for a living. He was brilliant, undoubtedly. Had issues with the law, had issues with chemical dependency, was at times prone to violence. But he was also other things. You know, people aren't just one thing or the other. There's so many facets. They're, you know, like a jewel in many ways, completely flawed and at times still beautiful. But we lived through times where he had been deported. He'd been here as an immigrant, married to my mother, but because of criminal convictions, he was deported. He reentered illegally, and he was prosecuted for that, and he was deported again. One of the first times I ever appeared in court was in an immigration court to go and talk to the immigration judge on behalf of my father while I was still a law student.
Do you think that even before, you know, before that day, the interpreter's not there, and you sort of by necessity have to use your Spanish, were you thinking about bilingualism in courtrooms, and were you thinking about specifically for those Spanish-speaking populations how you could, you know, what you could do or how you could do it?
You know, I always thought about how could I use my Spanish to essentially help people. I think your grandmother Olivia Aguirre was
my great grandmother.
Your great grandmother, my grandmother. Yes, you're right. Olivia Aguirre was an amazing woman. You know, she was the mother of 13 children. She was a community organizer. She found a way to get a farm workers clinic started in Toppenish, Washington. And if you go there, her mural is, as one of the founders of that clinic, is there on the wall. And she was one of those people that, you know, didn't know how to say no and would always be out there addressing issues on behalf of the people in her community. So I think she really instilled in us a sense of service. So I grew up with this notion of service. So I knew that I would use Spanish in some way. I just didn't know how. You and your brother don't speak Spanish,
right?
Ironically.
Right.
you're French and some Arabic, and he's very fluent in Japanese. But bilingualism was encouraged.
Was it?
We tried. Yes.
I don't think you did.
Well, you have to understand, your father was the primary caretaker. Now, that's more common nowadays, but back when your dad was doing it, I don't think it was necessarily as common. And you are familiar with your father's Spanish-speaking abilities.
He gets by. He gets by better than I do.
And we tried for many years. For a few years, your cousin was watching you. She came from Mexico, and she was studying here, and she was your nanny, and she would talk to you in Spanish, and you'd just respond in English. So there was a little time period where we tried, and then after that, it was, you know, you were going to be speaking English most of the time during 9 to 5, and I think it's hard without the immersion to really raise a bilingual child. There really has to be a dedication to the immersion, but it's never too late. You can still learn.
You had said once when I asked, you know, why didn't you teach me Spanish, when you once lamented that I can't speak Spanish, as if that was my fault. You know, you said, well, I wanted you to choose to learn it, which isn't really how language acquisition works.
Well, no, it doesn't work that way, but it kind of sometimes does, because you chose to learn French.
In high school.
You chose to learn Arabic.
In high school. If you recall what the deal was in high school, I had asked, will you teach me Spanish while I am concurrently learning French,
yes.
If you recall.
Absolutely.
And if you recall, you got frustrated because you would speak to me in Spanish, and then I would struggle to understand what you were saying because I don't speak Spanish. And then you get frustrated and just speak to me in English.
Yeah, it was frustrating, I think, for both of us.
Growing up as a Spanish-speaking woman of color in Eastern Washington, presumably you run up lots of people who are, I guess, pro-monolingual.
Absolutely. When I came back from Mexico to enter my freshman year, I went to go enroll in school, and I showed up the first day of school, and they wanted to put me in ESL classes. They didn't even sit there and interview me. They didn't ask me. They just saw that I'd come back from Mexico. So they immediately wanted to put me in ESL classes. And I sat there and I looked at him and I go, you know, I've been reading Shakespeare in Old English over this past summer. I think I got the English down. You know, the Canterbury Tales, Dante's Inferno. I read all the classics. At one point, I started going through certain authors, like the authors you're supposed to read. You know, I was going alphabetically, you know, Bronte's, the Dickens's, the you know, those books that everybody's supposed to read. And I told the vice principal that. And then they moved me into an honors English class, and I did just fine. I was not afraid of advocating for that.
Did you ever feel like you had to advocate that way for me when I was in school?
Only on one occasion. On one occasion, I remember you wanted to go to a private school called Holy Names. It's an all-girls Catholic school. And I remember going to the parents' day, and I remember asking a question about academic scholarships. I said, what is the process for getting the academic scholarship? That was my question. And their response was, those are way too hard to get. Does your daughter play sports? And of course, my response was, I didn't ask you about it. I asked you about the process. And it was one of those moments, you know, I felt that I had to advocate, that I had to somehow make sure that my expectations of you were always higher than whatever else the world expected of you. I wanted you to have the opportunities I did not, and to see what would happen. That was it. I am very proud of you.
Well, similarly, I am also proud of you. I don't know if you know that. Life has been good for me.
Even with the parading around with election signs and stuff.
Yeah. Yeah.
I love you.
I love you too.
That was our colleague Simone Alisea talking with her mother, Judge Veronica Alisea Galvan. And I've asked Simone to hop into the studio with us and listen to this piece. And first of all, thank you.
Thanks for having me. Yeah.
So what jumps out at you when you as you listen back to that StoryCorps interview that you did with your mom?
I think the thing that kind of surprised me is how like upset I sound. I was a little surprised that I like came at my mother so hard about not being taught Spanish. And I think the reason I had a chip on my shoulder about it, and perhaps still do, is you get gruff for it, which is true for a lot of Latino, Latina kids who don't speak Spanish, who grow up in families where Spanish is spoken. You know, you get a lot of gruff for, oh, why didn't you learn the language? Why, you know, you don't have pride in your culture. You don't, you know, it's something that was said to me growing up. And so I was like, wait a minute, you spoke Spanish this whole time. Why? This is not my fault. And so that was something that I think I had never really explicated.
Well, I have a little pop psych theory that I wanted to run by you, see if you think it holds any water.
Okay.
So your mom talked about her father and the instability of her household growing up,
mm-hmm.
moved from Mexico back to the United States, back to Mexico, and it was difficult. And it seems like maybe the bilingualism is associated with that instability, with actually like not ever really living in one place or the other. You, on the other hand, grew up in the United States. I sense that she wanted to give you a sense of stability, and maybe part of that was just, you know, no ambiguity. You are American. You speak English.
I don't think there is any question of Americanness in my family. You know, my great grandmother was born here, so I have more generations here in the U.S. than me. Some other folks do. But as far as stability goes, and language as a marker of stability or instability, I think there's maybe some credence to that. So much of what my parents did, I see as making up for all of the things that they didn't get when they were growing up. They get a lot of flack for having put me in private school, for example. You don't support the public school system. What? It's not good enough. But that's what you do when you didn't get a great education and you grew up poor and now you have some money and you're going to give your kid the best opportunity that they have. So I could buy that language is a part of that.
Well, Simone Alisea is a reporter and editor here at 88.5 KNKX. Thank you so much, Simone.
Thanks, Gabe.
That's it for our show this week. Sound Effect is produced by Kevin Kniestad and Jennifer Wing with Bethany Denton. We got help this week from Shane Mailing, Alex Ashley, Monica Spain, and Simone Alisea. Thanks also to StoryCorps. Aaron Hennessy is our executive producer. We also want to say a very big thank you to you. Our pledge drive was a huge success thanks to your generosity. We so, so appreciate your donations and support. They help keep programs like Sound Effect on the air. And if you didn't get a chance to make a gift during the drive, you still can. Just go to knkx.org. And be sure to tune in next week when our theme is I'm Into It. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and this is KNKX.